Oh, and we need to pass out tampons. We'll work by the time this class is over, we will remember that. And if our cloud host can put a link to, so if you have the chant book, I believe it's on page 59, the Metta Sutta. And if you, there should be a link in the chat if you don't have a chant book. Soon there will be a link in a chat, in the chat.
I'm putting the link in right now.
All right. All right. Metta Sutra. This is
This
what should be
is
done
what
by one who is
should be done
skilled
by one who is
in
skilled
goodness
in
and
goodness.
knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. May all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protests with her life her child, her only child. So, with a boundless heart, should one cherish living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Oh, this is, let's see, class number six out of this opening your heart series. If you want to listen to, if you've missed previous classes, there are recordings of the classes on the available on the website, both the audio and the video. This evening we're getting to self-acceptance, and I call this the first step to an open heart, self-acceptance. So in a way, maybe this should have gone at the beginning. But in many senses, for many of us, like real self-acceptance is hard. So in a sense, it's kind of good to talk about goodwill and compassion and sympathetic joy and all of this, and then talk about self-acceptance, because we kind of we're in that groove now after a bunch of weeks, and maybe we can start talking about self-acceptance. So just as an overview of the class, this is first time you're coming to the class, opening your heart, I'm calling one of the 10 Z fields of Zen practice. So we have Zazen, we have Dharma study, we have precepts, we have a lot of what I call the fields of practice, areas of practice. And opening your heart specifically as an area of practice, I think is very significant. And I think a lot of this does have to do with this, the necessity of self-acceptance before we progress very far on the path. And we're not just talking about low self-esteem, although that's not helpful either. When we think about the kind of self-acceptance that we're going for, it's kind of, the self-acceptance isn't complicated, but the reasons why it's difficult are complicated. We are complex beings. So even if we think of ourselves as maybe you kind of really struggle with self-acceptance, there's probably areas in which you're actually confident, maybe even arrogant, right? So there's we all have a mix of that within us. And a lot of times, as we're well aware with ourselves or others, what might seem like confidence or arrogance is sometimes actually of just hiding, insecurity and defensiveness. So we had a complex mix of stuff in there. And it's not just thinking about our, limitations, faults, all of that. It can also be kind of subtle. What when you contemplate yourself, why do you think I shouldn't be this way? I shouldn't do that. I shouldn't experience that. It could just be, in a way, dukkha as applied to ourself. So all of this is taking place with the backdrop of the teaching on Buddha nature, that we all have Buddha nature, we all are Buddha nature, we all are awakened nature. There's something like we're okay. We're fundamentally okay. So this is a koan for us. We think perhaps that the lack of self-acceptance is a modern problem. And certainly there's many things that we can look at in our modern society that don't help, right? However, this is the Lotus Sutra, which was composed over 2,000 years ago, Buddhist text. And so I'm going to read the parable. Read the parable of the lost son. A lot of times I just kind of tell the story quickly for expedience sake, but I thought it would be fun to really hear how the Lotus Sutra describes this. So, This is the Buddha speak. No, actually, this is Mahakasyapa speaking. It is like a youth who, immature and ignorant, left his father and ran away to distant lands. Wandering about from place to place for over 50 years, his anxious fa father searched for him everywhere. Until worn out from searching, he settled in another city, built a house there, and took pleasure in the five desires. And then it explains like he ended up quite wealthy and had, lots of wealth and homes and servants and all of this stuff. Tens of millions of billions of people surrounded and honored him. But as he became older and infirm, he longed all the more for his son. Day and night he wondered, "My time to die is coming. My foolish son has been away for over 50 years. All the things in my storehouses, what should I do with them?" At that time, the poor son was looking for food and clothing, going from city to city and from land to land, sometimes finding nothing, sometimes something. He became famished, weak, and gaunt, and covered with scabs and sores. Going from place to place, from one job to another, he wandered about, eventually coming to the city where his father lived, finally reaching his father's house. Just at that time, within his gates, the rich man had set up a great jeweled tent and was sitting on a lion's seat, surrounded by his dependents and various attendants. Some were counting gold, silver, and jewels, or incoming and outgoing goods, recording them in ledgers. The poor son, seeing how eminent and distinguished his father was, thought, "This must be a king, or someone like a king." Alarmed and full of awe, he asked himself, "Why have I come here?" And he thought to himself, "If I stay for long, I may be captured and forced to work." Having thought this, he quickly ran away in search of some poor village where he might go to work. The rich man on the lion's seat at that time saw his son in the distance and silently recognized him. Immediately, he ordered messengers to chase after him and bring him back. The poor son cried out in fright and fell to the ground in terror. "These men have caught me. Surely I will be killed. Why did I come here to look for food and clothing?" Knowing his son was foolish and feeling inferior, the rich man thought, "He will never believe my words, nor believe that I am his father." So, using skillful means, he sent some other men, one-eyed, short, common-looking, unimposing men. "Go and tell him," he said. "You will be hired with us to remove dung and filth, and you will be paid double wages." Hearing this, the poor son was glad and went with them to remove dung and filth and clean the stables. Through a window, the rich man always watched his son and thought about how he was foolish to be pleased with such menial work. Then the rich man, putting on tattered, dirty clothes and taking a shovel for dung, would go to where his son was. Using this skillful means to get near him, he encouraged the son to work hard, saying, "I have increased your wages and given you oil for your feet and plenty of food and drink and thick warm mats for a bed." Sometimes he used stern language, "Get on with your work." At other times he spoke gently, "You are like a son to me." Being wise, the rich man eventually allowed him to go in and out of the house. And after 20 years, made him manager of the house. He showed him gold and silver, pearls and crystal, and other incoming and outgoing things. All this to have him understand such things. Still, the son lived outside the gate, living in a grass hovel, regarding himself as poor and thinking, "None of this is mine." Knowing that his son's disposition was gradually becoming more open and generous, and wanting to give him his wealth, the father gathered together his relatives, the kings and ministers, the nobles and ordinary citizens, before this great assembly, he announced, "This is my son, who left me and went off somewhere for 50 years. And since I saw my son come back, 20 years have gone by. Long ago, in some other city, I lost my son. I went all around searching for him and eventually came here. All that I have, houses and people, I give entirely to him. He's free to use them as he wishes." The son thought of his earlier poverty and feelings of inferiority, and of how he had now, from his father, received such great treasures. Along with houses and buildings and all his wealth, he was overjoyed at having received what he had never had before. The Buddha, too, is like this. Knowing that we are pleased with small things, he did not tell us before, "You can become Buddhas." So, it's a story about low self-esteem from 2,000 years ago. So when we imagine ourselves as the lost son, what might keep us from self-acceptance? We'll have a chance to brainstorm some of those things in a moment. My own story is, I was always a little on the arrogant side, but the arrogance that's like a very fragile. So if somebody like criticized me or I failed at something or whatever, then I would feel a huge amount of self-loathing, right? So it's kind of like an either or. So as I started to practice and like starting to look at this stuff, when you start your practice and to study Buddhism is to study the self, and then you if you don't already know about this stuff, then you get to like open your closet and see, oh wow, So I really saw this. I don't know what bothered me most in my early years of practice was kind of my lack of skillfulness around other people. I would end up I don't know, rubbing people the wrong way, offending people through my speech or through what I said or didn't say. And it was like I couldn't do anything about it. It was like it would just be something that I kind of noticed after the fact. I also, had a sense that my teacher, because then you get once you practice for many years and then you have fellow students, and then inevitably you kind of compare yourself to the fellow students, and I noticed that like my Dharma brother was getting asked to do things that I wasn't getting asked to do. And I once kind of, I wouldn't say I never confronted my teacher with stuff, but I kind of asked her to be honest about it. Is there something about me that's causing you to hold me back? And her answer was kind of yes. And it was, I mean, I don't remember exactly what she said, but in a way I knew, right? It was like it was a kind of pride and self-centeredness that, if I had other kinds of shortcomings, like, I don't know, getting nervous in public and not being able to express myself, or forgetting stuff. Who knows? Like there could be other shortcomings, but the shortcoming of like being able to express myself well and being really proud of that and looking down at other people. If there's deadly sins, right? Pride is a deadly sin. So I felt that, but then I also felt like I have this inability to concentrate during Zazen, right? My mind is full of thoughts, And I felt like that was impeding me in my progress. You know, it was all this talk about emptiness and all that. And then there'd be the teachers and the senior students who'd be explaining, you know, answering, and they'd be telling me what emptiness was. And I felt like, I don't get it. I'm trying so hard and I just don't get it. So, I mean, there was a lot of stuff. And so there was a point in my practice where I just, well, and then also you like precept work and stuff, and you start to really observe your behavior. It's just, I remember there being a time when I almost couldn't stand to open my mouth because anything that came out was just so off, was just so like, I don't know, it was very painful. So I don't know. There was a period of time where I could, whenever I sat, and I'm not, I mean, I'm just a junior monk here, right? I just like, I couldn't sit up straight. It's just like, I mean, I was just so dejected. I just couldn't sit up. And I felt so miserable. But, you know, I tell my story, you know, on the podcast, and there's little awakenings that started to free some of this up. But I do remember once in a retreat where my teacher Gyoko Kho was giving a talk, and somehow, you know, you can hear things 100 times and it doesn't go in, and then you hear it. So I'm sure it's not the first time I heard this, but she was talking about our ancestors. So this is probably like, yeah, I don't know what retreat it was, but she was talking about the ancestors who, you know, awakened. You read these stories about how they awakened. And somehow she was saying, like, they were not different than you. They were not different. And like, somehow that went in. And I really was able to believe that. And it, you know, helped shift some of that, self-absorption, if you will, not wanting to accept our mind, our karma, our body, our limitations, thinking of all of these things that we wish were different. I'm just going to do that. I'll do a little brainstorm. So Mick, could you, you know, make sharing accessible? You don't have to make me a co-host. You can just say under share, you can just say let people share. And those of you who are in the cloud, I can't see all of you. So if you do want to contribute something, use the raise hand feature and you'll pop up to the beginning of the list where I can see you, or just unmute yourself and say something. So, reasons for lack of self-acceptance. If you kind of think about, you know, reasons why we might be the lost son or daughter who cannot accept our inheritance of Buddha nature.
Lack of external acceptance, like other people.
Question.
Yeah.
So, all this talk of self-acceptance, you know, and then kind of trying to tie that together with the idea that we are empty of self-nature, right? So, what does it mean to accept yourself when yourself is dynamic and not an impermanent, right? What does that mean?
Yeah. Mean, what does it mean? There's a saying that I love, without sentient beings, no Buddhas. So none of this practice, Buddhahood, all of this is irrelevant except that we are sentient beings, and sentient beings are always going to have this. Right. Even if it even if it's empty and ultimately can't be grasped, this is still the vehicle through which we live and awaken and or perpetrate, negative karma. So this is the vehicle that we ended up with. So, I mean, and it's not, and we'll get more into, like, well, how do we do this in a bit, but it's not about starting to tell a positive story about this being, like flipping it from a negative story to like, I'm great. But yeah, the recognizing that what really matters is not obstructed by any of this. So lack of self-acceptance, just when you think like this, I should be different, even if it's subtle. Dan.
Sort of jumping off this, what Drew brought up is just lack of being able to accept impermanence, which is necessarily imperfect. We want a static state.
Eric.
For me, I found a lack of self-forgiveness or internal forgiveness. Huge impetus to couple sentences.
So I'm thinking more, just a little more gritty, like about like past mistakes.
Sure. Well, and I think for me, it was, and that's what I want to clarify because it was more than just past mistakes. It was that underlying understanding that I am worthy as I am. Even in my past mistakes, not just, oh, I wish I hadn't done those things, or oh, I wish that things would have been different, but it's that I'm worthy, even if I made all the same mistakes again. That kind of self-acceptance, that kind of self-forgiveness.
John.
Can't remember stuff. Speaking for a friend.
My mind is always busy.
Depression.
You like the pretty.
Depression.
Oh, I said you like the
Is it
pretty.
perfectionism?
Depression.
Abuse.
Perfectionism. Harrison's
Early conditioning.
Societal
Yes,
conditioning.
yeah, I've got the same thing.
Here.
Dave or Ray.
Oh, somebody already said it while we were trying to figure it out.
And in a way, I'm thinking maybe I should phrase it more in terms of not reasons why we end up finding it difficult to summon self-acceptance, but what is it about ourselves we can't accept? What is it? So more internally focused. Ruth Ann, yeah.
That we're capable of being loved, that we're lovable, without effort, just because we're human.
So, we might not believe that, leading to a lack of self-acceptance.
Right, that we're lovable just for being who we are.
Let's see, Shoketsu and then Jen.
Shame.
Shame from early childhood treatment. And I go there easily.
Jen?
Like, what if just like actual faults, like greediness or self, you know, like cruelty or something that you really have, but you're not allowed to have?
Yeah, so qualities that we experience within ourselves.
And you have to have it.
Yeah, things you cannot, should not be. Mick and then Isaac.
Yeah, I think mine was kind of similar to what we just brought up. But yeah, for me, it's always like, if I notice something about myself, I always attribute it to, that's a flaw that I have. And if I notice the same behavior in somebody else, it's just like, oh, that's, you know, I don't know that they're always like that. And I think we just sort of internalize our own mistakes as part of this, you know, flawed person. We always want to attribute it to some fixed version of who we are that is broken. And that, for me, that's different than what I see in other people. I just think that somebody made a mistake or whatever.
Not giving them the benefit of the doubt when we're, it's a big, terrible deal for us. Like,
yes.
Like, I just, like, if you think about it, like, the, like, being really, really hard on ourselves in some ways is, like, really arrogant because, like, yeah, those, the low standards are fine for you. But not, no. No, not me.
I read my mind.
Isaac.
So, fear of permanence, then we are a fixed self.
Yeah, I like.
Sorry, blame, like self blame, especially for things for which we're not responsible.
Things like when you think about yourself that are just shouldn't be this way, or that if you could just magically change, you know, like how about our weight? Who wouldn't like to just magically, like, oh, I would just like to, you know, change my eating habits and then be X number of pounds.
Being high strung and emotional.
Being high, strong, and emotional.
Learning disability.
Learning disability. Dave and Ray.
Punitive mindset.
So then if you like make a mistake, not going to let yourself off the hook kind of thing. Isaac.
Selfishness. Self-centered.
Yeah, and these are the kinds of things like more mindfulness can really make us aware of. Anxiety, like anger. Shari.
Limitations due to physical or mental limitations due to aging or something that's out of our control.
I'm striving for more.
Yeah, kind of holding ideals for ourselves, goals for ourselves, and just Gathel.
I'm not entirely sure how to say this, but essentially being of a race, class, or sex is generally looked down upon by society or given less opportunity, essentially discrimination.
Yeah, I mean, we're not a completely like separate system in here, right? We're influenced by so much, by our experiences, by the way we've been treated. All right, so I'm gonna stop there because I'm gonna take us through a little meditation and find out how you like it. So, if you like, you can close your eyes. Don't have to. So every Sunday, and often at other times, we say a karma verse. All my past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. So, for a little bit, immerse yourself in all your past and harmful karma. Don't have to go searching for past sins, but just kind of open up that door. Things that you regret, things you want to change about yourself, limitations you have that make you sad, things you want to have done, ways you want to be in your life that you think maybe will never come about. Now think of your greatest or one of your greatest regrets or shortcomings. If you had the ability to undo or change one thing, it would be this. It can be subtle, major. And you don't have to second guess and think. It's true that most of us realize we wouldn't change ourselves because that's just who we are and we learn from it. But there's usually at least something that still causes us some regret or sadness. Something we feel some shame about. Some way that we are, we don't like other people to see. Now think of someone you profoundly trust and admire. If you're fortunate, maybe this is your mom. They don't have to be alive anymore. Maybe it's a good friend, family member, or teacher. You respect their perspective, their judgment, impartiality. You trust them to witness your regrets or pain or shame without judging you or comparing themselves to you or anything. So imagine you pour your heart out to this person, confessing your greatest regret or shortcoming. You hide nothing, letting them know exactly how troubled or chaotic it can be in your mind and heart sometimes. Usually you hold all of this close. Afraid that if anyone really knew the score, you would be disqualified from the human race, or at least from the company you seek. Imagine your trusted confidant listening, patiently listening until you have said everything that is in your heart. Then they embrace you, telling you it's all okay. You find yourself able to believe them, relaxing into their embrace with immense relief and gratitude. Finally able to see your limitations the way your friend sees them, as imperfections that simply add color to your Buddha nature. Able to lean on your friend's faith. At least for a little bit, you're able to see your mistakes and shortcomings could never disqualify you from being lovable, from belonging, from being a child of the Buddha. This is a visualization that I've done for myself. And, you know, like most meditations and visualizations or whatever, doesn't necessarily work in all circumstances. In some ways, if you can even just get it to work, even for a moment, gives a little taste of what real self-acceptance can be. You know, like, I don't know if anybody has anything that you want to share at this point, or questions or comments.
I err on the side of being really hard on myself, and I do that thing where I'm like, oh, if this was a friend, like, of course this is like not a big deal and you're just so wonderful.
That's okay.
Yeah. And then when I do it, I'm like, I am a failure. and something I told my friend like a few years ago, I was like, wow, I can't believe I'm saying this, and I have never done the same for myself, was being like, when I've noticed being really hard on myself, I'm like, how would I say this to him? How would I support a friend through this? Like a really close, one of my best friends. And that helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is like the corniest thing ever. I can't believe I'm about to say this out loud, but somebody, I go to all these conferences through work, and one of the keynote speakers was like, give yourself hugs. And I was like, at that thing, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe she just said that in front of a room of engineers. Like, it's just like the most ridiculous thing. And I was having a really hard day, and I was alone, and I hugged myself, and it was like, it was profound. Like, it was just amazing. And so I'm constantly shifting that perspective. It doesn't work all the time.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh, it's, I mean, it strikes me, you know, the meta practice, you know, the practice of goodwill, the instructions tell you to start with yourself because they think that's easy. I mean, you're supposed to start with an easy person, right? That's the whole point. It's like it's easy to feel it and then you can extend it. And I think maybe the ancients thought it was because, I mean, well, if we really think about it, we have a certain kind of goodwill for ourselves, right? Like
self-preservation.
Yeah, I want to make sure that like,
yeah, start with someone.
I mean, if you know, you like you want to be comfortable, and you want like you know the nicest slice of cake, and you know
Sure.
whatever, like that kind of self-interest, I guess. But real, like deeper goodwill, can recognize like kind of walk around with a sense of ill will toward myself all the time, right? We're not fast enough. We didn't get enough done. We didn't say bad. You know, like it's just like a kind of just like. And like sympathetic joy. Good job. Like, why don't we just let ourselves just, you know, be happy for ourselves? Ruthann.
Showing my vulnerability opens my heart without an agenda. So that's kind of humbling.
Nice. Eric.
It kind of goes into what you, Coral, were saying. But for me, I feel like I found that we do a good job of understanding selfish love for ourselves, the piece of cake, the well-being. But I don't know that we as a society or as a human race understand the spirituality of love. And I think we cannot fully share that or give that or know that until we live it by giving it to ourselves. And that has just been so profound to me, to not just like reward myself with, you know, a piece of cake or, you know, a night off or something like that, but to actually stop my thoughts and think, if I really loved myself, how would I treat myself? How would I act? How would I respond? And then how would I walk differently and talk differently? And so for me, that's what I wanted to share. You can't know metta until you give metta to yourself.
Yeah, thank you. Leah.
Well, there's a reason I came to the Zendo in person for this one. Because this is a very difficult one for me. And like you were just saying, like I walk around just berating myself all the time. I do. I just walk around just saying, well, I just didn't get enough done and the thing I did wasn't good enough and just so what I've noticed is that it's so simple. It's ridiculous that I just tell that you know inner critic, that voice that a lot of people have, just to wait and to hang on. And sometimes you know zazen during that time, that's a time when you just wait and get into the habit of telling that critic to just wait. You'll have time later to go ahead and read me the riot act of all the things I didn't do right or enough or all that, and then just you know just wait. And it helps me, I think, when I'm successful at it, to be softer about it to myself and say, instead of stop, no, don't, I say, well, just wait. We'll get back to this later. And then by that time, taking all the wind out of the sails. So, yeah, but this is tough.
Yes.
Tough one.
Yeah. It's very interesting. So I mean, there's many aspects of our practice, including opening our heart, which is something we're trying to work on, and we're trying to improve ourselves in a way, right? And we have precept practice, and we try to, you know, learn how not to indulge anger, and we sit, and we try to be more mindful, and like And so it can, like, our practice can end up like a self-improvement project. And so in the Lotus Sutra, when the Mahakashapa is explaining that the Buddha is like the father who's was skillful and, like, just had his son clean dung and filth because that's all he felt like he was, capable of. The Buddha too is like this, knowing we are pleased with small things. He did not tell us before you can become Buddhas. Instead, he's talking about the Buddha, you told us about becoming free of fault, fulfilling a lesser vehicle, and being Shravaka disciples. So that kind of the initial path of Buddhism about just, purifying yourself and kind of spiritual athleticism until you achieve nirvana. Is considered the, I mean, there's a time and a place for it. My teacher always said, so that's the Hinayana path, small vehicle. And we're not using that word to describe like Theravadan Buddhism. We're talking about practice that is aimed at self-improvement, essentially. The Hinayana and Mahayana, the great vehicle, that our practice has both. Like the Mahayana includes the Hinayana, right? There, we try to become better people and more mindful and all that. But then the great vehicle tells us that we already are Buddhas, and that none of that obstructs any of it. So it's like and but if we just said, well, I'm a Buddha, so I don't have to do any more work like that, then I'm missing it, right? Because now I'm just telling myself a story about being a Buddha and I don't have to do anything, and like that's not the reality of being a Buddha. So, what is it that we awaken to? And I guess before we taste it, we imagine that whatever it is we are looking for, whatever it is we were longing for, is perfection, and therefore all of this crap just it can't. Like, it's like the camel going through the eye of the needle, right? Like all this crap, I couldn't become a Buddha with all this crap. I've got to somehow purify this crap so that I can taste this greater truth. But then when we taste it, we realize it's like that hug in the meditation. Right? It really is like it does not exclude any of this. It's exactly like that, like that's okay. Like it's totally okay. Realize none, that when we're looking at ourselves like this and it all looks so awful when we look at it from the Buddha's perspective, it's not a problem. None of it is a problem. So we have a few minutes left. If anybody has any final words or statements? So how do we work on self-acceptance? I mean, I guess we just try it. We just, but all of our practice is kind of aimed toward this as well. That's part of trying to awaken to the larger perspective. That's why one of the main words used in Zen to talk about awakening is Kensho, is seeing the true nature of the self. And whether that is a gradual thing, whether that's a dramatic thing or whatever, it's an essential thing. It's seeing the true nature of the self. Which is seeing, like Drew said, that it's empty, but But it's not empty, like, therefore it doesn't exist, right? You see where emptiness is liberating. Emptiness is what gives us, it breaks us free from this. When I remember being, you know, the kind of criticism that used to just devastate me, right? Like, I don't know. Like, let's say tomorrow I get an email and somebody says, like, you know, that was just terrible what you said last night. And, you know, I don't know. Like, and I recognize that, like, there's some truth in it, right? That maybe I did something really sensitive or I missed something or whatever. Like, that in the past would have just, like, you know, it would have just, like, oh my God, you know, I am so, like, there's so, there again, what people were saying, like, there's something wrong. There's a fixed flaw in here, right? I'll never get through the gates of heaven now. Like, there's still that sin, that I don't know, contamination or whatever that's in there. And this mistake was just a sign. It's just a sign that I still suck, you know? And I don't know. I mean, it's not an immediate thing, but the gradual thing is, like, now it is really, it is difficult for me to imagine anything anybody could say to me that I wouldn't be like, wow, that's too bad. I'll try to do better. As it just has nothing, like, I don't know, it just glances off because it's not going to ruin my Buddha nature. I know that, right? So anything else is, I mean, you can be sincerely regretful, right? You can be sincerely like, I really, you know, I'm so sorry that happened and I'm really going to try to do better, but it doesn't actually have anything to do with us, right? It's just this kind of, it's this karmic package that we're riding through this lifetime that isn't perfect. Eric, one more thing.
I do have one more thing. Oh, I'm sorry. For those of you who don't know, despite all my careers, my background is actually in early childhood. And many, many years ago, when I was getting my education, one of the things that we were taught over and over and over again as we were doing the different stages of development is you cannot spoil a baby. There is no way to spoil a baby. There is no way to give a baby too much love, no matter what you think about what you're doing. There's no way to spoil a baby. And as you were talking tonight and as listening to everyone, I thought about what if we approached our Buddha nature like it was a baby and we nurture it. And we say, no matter what is going on around me, or no matter what society tells me, or no matter what I feel, I can never love my Buddha nature too much. I can never nurture it too much. I think that's what I'm going to do. So I want to share that.
You think of being a good friend or a good parent to yourself, you know, and when you, I don't know, when you have a limitation or something, do you really want to be the parent who's just like, yeah, stupid, you're never going to amount to anything? I mean, that's really what we say to ourselves inside sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is like the way we treat ourselves. If we saw anybody else being treated that way, we would be like, I'm calling Child Protection Services. This is not acceptable. And I think so. I'll share one more story before we take off. So many of you will hear me say this. I think I wrote about it on the podcast, but I was sitting in retreat and like I was beating myself up like that. And I actually had a visual of myself in a corner, like just like cowering down like this with this other part of myself just being like, and I don't know, somewhere out of some other part of myself arose a big lady. She was a big lady. And she got in between the cowering one and the voice, and she said, you leave her alone. Like, and this just, and you know, and it was kind of like, no, like, where did she come from? And I just like I never did that again. Never did that again. Just, you find that within you. You find that space or that, voice, that capability that's just like, no, that's not how I'm gonna treat myself. Right. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all Arhats, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Mahaparamita, Paramita. Thank you all for coming.